This is CliffCentral.com.
The Deputy Minister of Telecommunications and Postal Service, Professor Hlengiwe Mkhize, is here with us this morning. I'm delighted to meet you, Deputy Minister, and thank you so much for coming to speak to us. There's a lot that we need to talk about, and there's so much of this that is exciting. It's about the future, government technology. And I think that you may just be able to shed some light for us on some of the things that many young people in this country are very, very interested in. Thank you for making yourself available.
Thank you very much for having me. It's really a good opportunity, you know, coming out of such an exciting event. Although it's an annual event, the spirit was just so high about new technologies. And I think what also emerged strongly is how now things are beginning to talk to each other, you know, not having technology for only one aspect of a person's life, but also seeing how everything comes together around a person.
You're talking, of course, about GovTech 2016, which was a conference that many people have been waiting for. This is, I suppose, in some ways, it's groundbreaking because government technology isn't just about systems and computers and all of that stuff. It's really also helping people to understand how technology can impact positively on the lives of the rural poor, of students, of all the varying groups that we're hearing quite a lot from this year. How exactly did this come about? Who decided to bring this into fruition?
You know, this is the 11th session, GovTech. Initially, it was about creating awareness, looking at other countries that they have this GovTech. You know, South Africa has always been part of the international community. But then we didn't have clear policies as to how we see technology as an anchor of service delivery and of fast-tracking development of all citizens in general. There has been no clarity on ICT policy. And for some reasons, if you look at last year's GovTech and this one, just so much has happened just within 1 year. For instance, we have now the cybersecurity hub. Mm-hmm. We have been driving the school connectivity program. We have been looking at how to assist nurses in rural areas to connect with specialists, mobile health. And so it happened when things have been happening on their own without a policy. And luckily also the integrated ICT policy was approved by cabinet 3 weeks ago or so. So, you know, the timing was perfect for people to then sit down with a clearer understanding and to evaluate what next should happen to achieve the envisaged 100% connectivity by 2030.
Deputy Minister, your department, the department that you and Minister Siyabonga Qwele run, is in some ways, you know, there was a separation of the one cabinet post into two. It was communications, and now it's telecommunications. The postal service and communications remains a separate portfolio. But in many ways, this is such an integral department to the way that government functions. How do you and the minister determine what is and isn't within your ambit? Or is that something that's decided by cabinet as a whole, by the president? Now you have the post office, you have there's certain things that ICASA reports to you on, there's certain things that ICASA reports to the other ministry on. It does get confusing for the public to understand how this all works. It must be simple for you, otherwise you wouldn't be able to do it.
No, it's sometimes it's difficult for us as well. I remember earlier on when we were appointed, at one point the minister said, let's go and sit down and talk to the president. And we didn't get to do it, but there were difficulties between the two ministers, and the president called all of us to come and sit down, and the mandate was looked at, was revised, and the two ministers signed. You know, one thing which I think has been a good outcome out of this is that it really gave us that space to look at ICTs and help the government, other government departments also to understand it, how it can carry their objectives. Another advantage which I didn't mention was also the UN leaders last year, when evaluating the MDGs, adopting the sustainable development goals, then they made ICT as a ghost goal, which should influence all of them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the separation, we still believe it should be as short term as possible.
Okay.
Because really, besides the advantage and the benefit, I can tell you now, looking long term, the separation is artificial. The world is moving towards convergence. Mm. But before I go to that, the confusion, impact could be greater if not managed for our state-owned entities, because they service both departments. Mm. The regulator, for instance, you know, now in our ICT integrated policy, there's a proposal for a second regulator, a regulator which will focus on economic aspects.
Mm-hmm.
You see, so it's almost like now we're feeding into the separation.
Yeah, I mean, for example, I understand that, you know, when people are paying their TV license, they're also paying for satellites that enable all kinds of other communications. It's not just for what the SABC does with the money. And many people don't understand that. And some of that must also fall within your ambit, as opposed to perhaps what is, you know, Minister Faith Mutambi's business.
Exactly.
Yeah.
USASA, for instance, they are under us mm-hmm. as a state-owned entity. But on some aspects, they have to cooperate very closely with Minister Mutambi when it comes to digital migration.
Mm.
Spectrum. ICASA, when it comes to spectrum, has to negotiate with two ministries.
Mm.
The digital migration aspects of manufacturing of set-top boxes, they are managed by USASA, an entity which falls under us.
Yes.
But they are managed and accountable to Minister Mutambi. When it comes to also digital migration and the set-top boxes distribution, the post office accounts directly to Mutambi, and it's our baby. So there are quite a number of areas where you realize that for officials, it must be more difficult.
Yeah.
At a political level, because it's dry, it's policy, strategy, we are managing it.
But in other ways, you've created more work for yourselves.
For them in particular, you know, these support structures, even the regulators, sometimes you can see that policy directives could sometimes create a tension. So that's why I said moving forward, the thinking everywhere we go, people say remain thinking convergence.
Mm.
Even with our ICT policy review, we have a chapter looking at broadcasting, because with these platforms we are looking at and moving towards the next level, the 5G, Internet of Things.
Mm.
You know, within one platform, you can have everything. A video, a television, you know, YouTube, whatever you want to have, you can have it with one platform. So we are conscious of the need to remain thinking aligned.
Well, I've got a dog in this fight because, you know, we're in an environment where we rely very heavily on the internet, and where many of our listeners have to use mobile data in order to receive the information, the entertainment, the communication that we deliver. I know you've been facilitating many of the discussions around our Data Must Fall movement, which is obviously something which is controversial in some ways, but is inevitable in others. Even the networks realize that by this time next year, they'll have to have halved their rates. The political parties are all on one side on this issue, which is something that rarely happens. The regulator seems of a mind to make these things happen. And then you have the public and pressure brought by movements such as ours. This is obviously pointing in one very specific direction.
It featured strongly, incidentally, during this GovTech. Of course, Minister Gcwele kept on joking, saying, I'm tired of things must fall. I want things that must rise. Basically, if you look at our policy, okay, there are a few things that we discuss. We said data is the kind of resource now, which is like water.
It's currency.
And electricity. Yeah. It's a bread and butter issue in any family.
In fact, there are some people who would prefer to have data than to eat.
Because that's when children can study, if you have data and you are connected. And also now, as we look at using ICTs to connect with health specialists, there are many things where they say you can inquire here if you see these symptoms, contact this center and so on, reporting cases. One of the women, of the people who got an award on Sunday evening, is a woman who had access to data, and then they had a special application. They started dealing with issues of gender-based violence. So people are using data for the basics. So we are saying open access is really meant to ensure that the operators have no reason to raise their costs under the guise of saying it's too costly for us to manage the networks. But also on
and none of them are not profitable.
Yeah. On the side also of government, you know, we are saying we have to, through the regulator, we have to look at pricing, the cost analysis, so that an operators and the regulator have to find a way of looking at where operators can still make their money, but bring data costs in line with other countries at the same rate with us. It's actually an imperative, because even the ITU has clearly said it cannot be, you cannot charge data at more than 2.5% of a poorest person's minimum wage.
Right.
So in our instance, we have looked at using also the spectrum to deal with the data issue, but also while talking to different people to bring smart, cheap phones initially, even if they are assembled here, CETA will be looking strongly at that. Because if you look at what makes the cost, it's not one aspect, it's what happens in the value chain. And we're looking at multinationals as to what role can they play as well in this journey. And so there's a general acceptance on the right to access this critical resource for basic survival and for economic inclusion, which emerged very strongly. Students were saying, we must study, we must acquire critical skills for economic inclusion.
Absolutely. And I think this is a single. When we went to Parliament and we met with the Honourable Kubai, who was heading the Portfolio Committee, we were saying to her that essentially this is the single greatest tool that could emancipate women and children in rural areas, that could emancipate students who can't afford their fees to go to university. This is the way that people can share information, they can connect with their families, with their friends, with the stuff that they need from a health point of view, from a, you know, an information point of view. There's so many reasons that this is priority number one for most young people in South Africa, and even older people who have felt for the longest time that the only way they could be communicated with was through broadcasters or through post or through any of those other things which fall under your and the other communications department. Do you think that there needs to be an understanding at the start of free expression being protected in these environments, of government, instead of being regulatory here, freeing things up so that people can have more open, honest, free communication? Because if that's part of the policy from the outset, it'll probably have a lot more buy-in from everyone, including private enterprise, including the public at large, student movements, opposition parties.
I think, as you saw with the portfolio committee, starting with ours, all members of parliament are in agreement, are united around this. which is a positive thing, and it's a it makes life much more easier. Nobody's opposed to it. For me, you know, yesterday we had a snap discussion with Vodacom. It was the session towards the end of the day, which was looking at what's happening in school connectivity. There are young people, I think some of them are graduates from VETS and so on, who have come up with applications and digitized information like the past exams and so on. So they are enriching what is being done. But we were then discussing the CEO of Vodacom in terms of saying, look, the private sector here has to come to the party in terms of ensuring that when we connect schools, for instance, we don't want to go back to a school and find the gadgets packed away, which were issued through a regulatory process, which I agree with you that is, we need more than a regulation. Mm. And you find that they haven't had data. It happened to us. We went to 3 schools in the Eastern Cape 4 weeks ago, and that was an experience. But he agreed also. He said, look, we need now to move faster, closer and closer conversation between right. us and the key players in the private sector at the moment. Because even when the theme, it talks about inclusive digitization, at the center of all this is how is a young person in the rural areas of Lisigisigi going to be able to connect if he goes to the post office and then the post office is not connected? There are data-related problems. I know with students, Cell C and Telkom have come forward to make sure that students get free data,
yes.
which is a good thing. But we are seriously looking at conversations with the key players, Vodacoms, the MTNs, and some of the multinational companies, and see how we move faster to meet the needs, because the voice of civil society was clear. After you went to Parliament, I went to Backchat, it was yes. the same.
And who could be opposed to this? I mean, who's on the other side of the argument?
I think basically now we're at the point where is to how to make it work.
So there isn't really an opposition to this movement at all. It's more that there has to be a reasonable way of making it work for everybody. And the operators aren't the enemy.
At this point in time, I think, like, during this, it's like people were yearning for an opportunity to engage on critical issues, because we are even talking to them about their enterprise development and say, if people are struggling with data, they're not going to connect with Vodacom or MTN enterprise division and express their needs and aspirations. Mm. So everything hang around data now. So between us, the tripartite alliance, government, regulator, private sector. No, it's not tripartite. Civil society activist.
It's a quarter split.
Quartrite.
Yes.
We have to have intense discussions and find a way. And I think the timing is now.
Now, Deputy Minister, I can't let you go without talking a little bit about your own past and your own history. In South Africa, it's illustrious. I mean, you went to a very, very famous school where your political career started. And I think a lot of people might want to know how it was that you ended up being the deputy minister and all the things that you've done before that, because they're very interesting things. Let's start with Maurice Isaacson High School, a fabled school now. There's so many of our political leaders who came from that school. Who was in your class at the time?
Well, you know, starting with Simon Hatebe is one of them. Mazibuko was much junior,
uh-huh.
who is now a famous activist,
yes.
was behind. But you know how that school, we worked with Mkabela, Ishmael Mkabela, Frank Chikane, Edna mm-hmm. Lady High, and we had anchor people who were dismissed from the University of Teflop. They were young. They were given an opportunity by the principal, Mr. Matabate, to teach. But instead of teaching, they identify a few students from the schools, which ended up matching towards Pefeni on June 16, years later, because we started much earlier.
Sure.
So most in Tenteni, we went to exile, he came back, he worked at SABC.
That's right.
And Tami Tenteni. Yes, was there. And a few others. Of course, others have disappeared in the private sector now, doing all sorts of interesting things. And really there, it was all about your conscience and your future, which you didn't know what you were talking about.
And you knew this is something that you needed to stand up for. This was something that mattered more than just learning about what the curriculum had in store for you. And also you realized at that young age already that there was a lot of injustice that you needed to be a part of remedying.
Well,
that's quite a decision for a young lady to make.
No, but you don't. It was not even. I always say, it was not even a decision. You just got a conviction as you interacted. Maybe it's influential, also sincerely committed activist. That's what I always say to people, and say, if we lose our people, then they don't experience us as sincere in what we're driving. I mean, those guys, when you sat down with them and you listened to them, it was like listening to the preacher and standing up saying, I must be converted. I have a role to play. They just spoke. Nengwenkulu will come and address. After that, he was recently in democracy. He was, I think, he had a position in the north, whether he was a director of education or something. He addressed us in 1972, and he left for Botswana. So there was a kind of sincerity in those leaders in saying, here we are today, there are challenges, there's nothing you can do about them, you were born into them. Use your conscience to be an agent of change wherever you are. And really, they made you to believe, whether you went to Sales House or Edgar's, the famous store, or Park Station, or not to mention educational settings.
Sure.
We all knew there was work to be done.
And Deputy Minister, you went over to the United States for a while and you studied there and then came back and joined the UDF.
Well, you know how I went to the U.S.? There was then this call for all of us who were in universities to go and talk to universities. There was a special scholarship under the name of Professor Eggman. So I went under that with some of the people, this guy who has been a professor at the University of Technology in Durban, Iqbal, is it Iqbal? Very good scholar. So we had an opportunity. I went. Our mandate was to talk about apartheid and campaign for the release of Mandela as a leader. Because at that time, it was clear that too many people were dying. Post-1976, the state got more violent and aggressive, and so the mobilization of the international community became critical. And that's what we did. And then there you'll come across other people who were there for different reasons. I remember Sioka, Bishop Sioka was in Chicago at that time. And when we were connected for other things, but they were already leaders. There was the Sithole family who had been from Newcastle, who have been there for many years. Then I moved from the University of Chicago, where I was based. I will go to the one in Illinois, Urbana-Champaign,
and Mississippi?
Northwest Mississippi. I was there in 1989.
Right.
And just to show us what happens, the legacy of racism, sometimes that it takes longer for people, like where it was, discrimination was very strong.
Well, Mississippi is one of the last states to kind of progress.
Yeah. But there, the message was to also expose to issues of black history, but to say also the legacy tends to be stubborn. During transitions, what is important is to work harder and make sure that the public doesn't lose confidence in what you're trying to do, because the remnants will be with you for too long. And so with us, you know, those were some of the critical experiences one had to take everything with all seriousness. And sometimes you find that you become almost like a misfit, because people wonder, what's your problem? Why are you doing all what you're doing?
Well, it's foot soldiers for the movement, really. And if it weren't for those individuals keeping that alive, it may not have reached the critical mass that it needed to internationally, right?
Not at all. Yeah. Basic, you know, one thing with leadership, you really have to live what you preach. Mm. Last week, I spent a lot of time at former Deputy Minister of Social Development, an old lady, Manduli.
Yes.
She was struggling at a completely different level as a farm laborer. Mm. And then she started, as you know, these innovative people, a small factory where she was making wedding attires mm-hmm. for a village where she was born. And, you know, we used to talk with her, and people were saying the same thing throughout the week there, that, you know, consistency as a leader in terms of commitment to upliftment of the people and taking all necessary steps to ensure that people believe in you as an authentic leader, it goes a long way, because she became a leader till the last. Till the time when she died. Mm. She was serving as a chancellor somewhere now, coming from nowhere as a farm laborer. She was the living light. But to me, what used to be a common ground with her was this consistency and avoid any form of contradictions. Where there are contradictions, should be tabled and spoken about, so that the issue was never lose the people.
Deputy Minister, we'll skip ahead a little bit, because there are so many things in your interesting life that I think deserve mentions, and I don't want to turn this into something too biographical. But you were also commissioner at the TRC, which must have been one of the toughest jobs. I mean, that was such a fractious time in South Africa. There was so little to really hold the thing together, to keep the center in place. And to be on the TRC, which has been criticized really unfairly, I think, by a lot of people since then, for not having done enough, as if it were unrestricted in its powers and authority, which it wasn't. Do you feel that the job done by the TRC is one that is maybe underappreciated by people now?
You see, it goes back to how we've managed the transitions. Some of my peers, when we talk, they say there are too many things that we assumed. We did, you know, I remember during the TRC, we would go around and meet with people who had adopted different approaches. The Germans, for instance, emphasized the importance of prosecutions. And in other countries, they did other things. So here we didn't consistently enlighten and communicate why we made the choices which we made at the time. It was important at the time to bring South Africans together, because people had been divided by the apartheid regime systematically for too long. If, for instance, you studied at WITS or UCT, or went through good schools where you had no interaction with activists, people couldn't go easily to townships, then you really believed all was well. Mm. You'd smell here and there that, you know, these people are treated differently. Maybe you see the worker, but people have been divided for too long. So it became important to say, let's create a mechanism which will not antagonize people, but a platform where we can talk. And I remember those days, there was one old man, I was with Mary Button, it was a radio station, he called, he could hardly talk. He said, you know, I'm Jewish, I've been in this country for too long. There are things I didn't believe, but today I believe. It was after the hearings when the security agents admitted in an amnesty committee that, well, we knew the system. We were told go to this place, take so and so, and go there. We knew what we should do. It was an unwritten rule. When we get there, we'll then decide what to do. Maybe we'll have a braai, we'll get meat, we'll get sit around a nice barbecue, beers, and then we'll start the job. Either to bury a person or to start banning you completely if people think there will be evidence that could be identified earlier. And so that old man said, I didn't believe it was so bad. But when perpetrators themselves gave these testimonies and people said, aha. So we all realized things had gone wrong. But then we should continue to then find something which will bring all of us together, almost like an ideology, stronger sense of moving forward in terms of transformation. Even the, you know, question of transformation of the economy, which now is really like a burning issue. We didn't bring everybody together that, well, we've now found each other, we've prayed together, we can mingle, and we've said, let's move forward. But how do we then ensure that, as it is in the Constitution, we redress the imbalances of the past? We created a vacuum to a point where I think now people who are in the liberation movement, they are on the back seat. Incompetent, you are failing. Nobody really understands the difficulties of transforming lives or empowering people who have lost out the most, as it was said, from an education point of view, general social skills development, knowledge and competences.
It's like you're damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Yeah.
And look, I think there are a lot of people who appreciate that there are very many capable and positive and passionate and determined people who are trying to do the right thing. I mean, your track record speaks of this. But we don't want to also separate people into the good and the bad, because otherwise you're not doing anyone any favors.
It doesn't help us.
Certainly. But Deputy Minister, the one thing that you did have some oversight in and a large amount of influence in was the Ministry of Higher Education prior to this latest cabinet, where you were the Deputy Minister of Higher Education. Mm. Looking at higher education now, I know this is no longer your responsibility, but at the time, was there any forewarning that things would become so derailed as they are now, where higher education is under a real threat?
I think it was clear. It has been clear for some time that there were problems. I remember that time, the question of admission was a big problem, in the sense that, you remember the woman who died at the University of Johannesburg? We had this critical mass of students now who wanted to enter these universities. They were bringing a different culture, in the sense that they were not used to, you know, they were not coming from schools where, if you have been with the St. Stidians and all this, you knew that by such and such a date, April so much, closing date. It's either you are in or out, St. Right. John's. They were bringing a different culture. So we spoke about a central admission system after the death of the woman who was pushing, because the website of the university was not up, and she couldn't engage the university. So the admission was a problem. The criteria in our university has been a big problem. There were people with 8 distinctions or 7 distinctions who couldn't get into a medical degree. And we were saying, look, all over the world, and then other countries will take those students. Mm. Some they will go to Oxford, some they will go to Cuba, and some. And that reason was due to the fact that we had not expanded universities. VETS, UCT, Natal University had its standard constituency, the schools that were feeding into these universities. Now, We open up the universities, but there have been no expansion. From an academic staff point of view, there has been no thinking about these admission criteria. Whether do these other students whom we say now they can go, will they meet the criteria without lowering the standards? So those problems were there. You could see that. And as a rule, most of these students couldn't afford the fees. I remember at one time we discussed this with some of the students at the SAPC. There was a special program run by young people. And they were saying at that time, you know, advance, you have to pay 100,000. And NSFAS was not going to meet, assist those students who were going to the university with nothing. So there have been those problems. And from an academic point of view also, we knew the difficulties of bringing these students who were not in par with high performers coming from very good, solid schools with a culture of discipline, competitiveness. So all these things, I mean, if you look at what has happened towards the end, it's there are people who almost like now they have a phobia. They don't want to face exam. They don't want to go to class. They don't want to sit and expose to themselves to the culture shock. Even when I was at 1990 to about 1994, I was at VETS. Black students were struggling, not because they were intellectually inferior. The culture was different. Dr. Pelue Lolwane, she has an agent somewhere at VETS now, visiting, you know, as a retired professor. She used to work at the counseling center, and she used to say to me, you know, these students came with distinctions. The student is breaking down, was in engineering. He has to leave the university. What should I do? And we'll talk to people like Sheila Menkes, who are in the transformation, and all the activists there. And basically, the institutions, the environment was not conducive. So we were aware, NSFAS, the only thing we could change with NSFAS was that, look, let's not say students must register first. Let's pay upfront. Because if you say register first, it means the grandmother, Coco, must be able to access the bank and say to the bank, give me a credit and so on. And when will she pay? How will she pay? So that's one thing we achieved. But the administration of NSFAS, when I was still there, it was also not satisfactory. Universities were saying that to us. So some of these problems, which really now have somehow, you know, exploded. We're dealing with a flame.
Yeah.
Now we're dealing with a flame.
Do you think that that maybe you could have done more? I mean, you know, hindsight's always a very accurate thing. But in the time, did you feel that you were doing enough? Did you feel that it was under control? Because where we're at now is clearly an impasse, and it could damage not just the chances of the very poor students, but all students.
Yeah, the country.
Yeah.
You know what's happening? It's painful because it's not about the education sector. It's really about the country.
Yeah.
If you look at the aspirations of young people, we thought, as Mandela said, education is the weapon that can turn things around, whereby a laborer's child could end up being the master. You see, when I look back, I think Casey Khwale said to me, it was a radio show, he said, why are you not resigning? I think she said the same thing to Blaine Zuma. No, she said it to me and said, Blaine Zuma, why are you not resigning? Blaine Zuma, why is he not resigning? Even at that time, we realized that much more could have been done. But now, you know, looking back, I start saying a lot more could have been done to manage this before they reach the point, the boiling point. I remember different campuses will call us, Medunsa and so on. And then at that time, the DG will be expected to go and engage with them. And now when I reflect, you know, now sitting where I am with time, if maybe the unions are not happy or something, I jump. I go with and meet with them and sit down. Mm. We had that situation at the post office. For students and lecturers, I know Minister Nzimande has done his bit and the Deputy Minister Manana there, but I still think the situation we're in today could have been prevented.
Yeah, I think a lot of people wish that it had, but you know, again, we can't, it's not a perfect science to go backwards in time and change things from the point of view where you actually can't. I'm curious also about the post office. You brought it up now. The post office falls fairly and squarely within your ambit, and that's been taken over. You've appointed Mark Barnes to run it. There have been a lot of changes. Is it working? Are you happy with what's happening at the post office at the moment? Is there any plan to turn it into a state bank of a kind?
Well, already there's work which was started long before our time. All what we've done now was to make sure that we push harder between the Ministry of Finance, Treasury, and the Reserve Bank to make sure that we realize the post bank. I think now all the barriers have been removed now. It's a question of implementation. I think the coming on board of Mark Barnes symbolically was very, very important for our financial institutions because he didn't come as a typical public servant.
Mm.
Then it gave that confidence that really government is serious, is committed in turning the situation around. We could then, for the first time, get a letter from Treasury, which allowed them to be able to seek funding to clear all the problems that they have. During this GovTech, the message was clear. The guy in charge of their information, technology officer made a presentation, and people appreciated one thing, that Mark Barnes' understanding of the financial model of any business, it's a plus, but they are expected to move faster in terms of ensuring that the post office becomes a hub of digitization. So that rural people are not left behind, they access opportunities, but also for economic inclusion, issues of food security, using e-platforms and advising them about water, marketing their goods, and looking at routes that are ideal for their people, and engaging farmers and new and small-scale farmers. So they are under pressure also to be a digitization hub. I think Tom Ngwabe, the officer who presented in a few sessions, got that message clear and unambiguously. And I actually thought, because, you know, our members of parliament were there, it was important to bring the post office back now to look at their digitization plan, because the future of the post office will be ensuring that it becomes a hub of internet.
They really have moved you around a lot in the last few years. Correctional services, higher education, economic development, now telecommunications. I mean, you were also an ambassador, people might remember, to the Netherlands. Haven't you done your service now?
Yeah.
Don't you feel it's time for someone else to take over all this hard work and to have to keep fixing departments?
Yeah, maybe you should have asked me how do you feel? You know, our past, our past live with us for too long.
Mm.
You know, you become like a soldier.
Mm.
I remember when I was taken out of higher education, we're in Cape Town. Minister Nzimande was supposed to host ministers from the continent. And then I was deployed. I had to leave higher education and go to economic development. You know, it's not easy, you know, because when you are deployed, you are deployed at the time when you have a program.
And you've got when you're on just top getting of your something. Teeth, yeah, you're just getting your teeth into something.
Yeah. You know, you it breaks you. You fell. they don't appreciate this and so on. You know, I remember I stayed, I finished the program. The next 2 or 3 days, I didn't walk away, take a flight, come back and say, now I'm going to economic development. I stayed with them. And I think I didn't even mention it. But because they are politicians, every morning they were checking the news. They are the ones, those ministers who started saying, oh, Your Excellency, now we see you'll be going to economic development. We'll really lose you, we'll miss you. But I think what has helped me with all this really is this old-time discipline where you think, well, I must look at the bigger picture. It's not about me. It's about the cause. If the movement think that's where I should go. But what has been good for me is that when I look at this, not so much correctional service, but starting with higher education, economic development, and where I am today, really, the relationship has been amazing. Because in higher education, it was a start of taking money from the department labor, the skills money, to here. We were talking skills, what the private sector should do, and so on and so on. So when I moved to economic development, where we had this new growth path and the targets for jobs and so on, the issue of skills that I took from there, it became very, very important. Even now, Ibrahim Patel will say, I count on you to talk about growth and jobs. So where I am, I'm very comfortable when talking to these players because I know what is critical. Transformation for me is not a philosophy. It's the number of new jobs they will create and also the skills issue. So there has been...
But despite all your hard work, don't you feel that in many ways... It just feels that we haven't achieved all the things we wanted to. I mean, we've got very little growth at the moment. If anything, we're shedding jobs. Employing more people in government is only adding to the tax bill. It's not creating wealth and prosperity, and it's certainly not growing the economy. Don't you feel that sometimes people have unrealistic expectations of government, of particular ministries, and that no matter how hard you try, it doesn't seem that there is much success to be told of? You know, a lot of people would like to say at the moment that the entire government is a failure. I don't think that's fair. I don't think you would agree that that's fair. But it's also very, very hard to stand up for an administration which seems to have not delivered for so many people.
Yeah, you see, we spend a lot of time focusing on policy. And sometimes I think this is what we knew. Because if you think of struggle years, you know, a lot was done to think about policies, the new constitution, and all activists, UDF years, were just years of envisaging the future. So we were very good in that, and I think we're good at it, but I think we stayed for too long. We should have looked at high-impact programs much earlier. I'm not even talking...
The NDP, for example.
Yeah. Even now, people are still... We're saying the same thing during this new growth path, that telecoms and postals, we want high-impact programs. Mm. And I think focusing on the charters and BEE was good, but it somehow distracted us from a bigger picture of partnering with the private sector for high-impact programs which will involve as many people as possible. Mm. Because BEE tended to just benefit the few. Mm. And then we'll start talking about the richest people, the wealthiest people.
And then we get caught up in arguments about whether it is policy or implementation, and actually nobody benefits from that either.
Yeah, no. Because really people want something which will have impact on their lives. So that's why now we have to accelerate our efforts and move away from the comfort of talking about policies. Because when you look, the debates we'll have about gear, they went on forever. And when you look at it, it didn't benefit Mamkize. who are struggling to feed children. Recently, we had a presentation from agriculture, which was showing us the number of people who go to bed hungry. High
it's
percentage.
Horrible to think
it's
about.
It's shocking. It's shocking.
Deputy Minister, thank you for coming to speak to us this morning, and congratulations on another successful GovTech. And again, I've got to say, from a personal point of view, thank you for your support and your interest in Data Must Fall. It's a non-hostile campaign. We don't see it as a pitched battle between anyone, government, the private sector, the operators themselves, the public, other political parties. We see it as a way of helping every South African to connect with every other South African and the world. And we appreciate the efforts that your department has made to assist us in this respect. But I hope that we can intensify this, and I hope that you have a continued and distinguished career in this department and any others that you end up being deployed to. But thank you for your contribution.
Thank you for taking a stand as well. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you very much.
Yeah. This is CliffCentral.com.